you know, this subject, prayer, inner guidance. I guess prayer and inner guidance, they get an affirmation too. They're all sort of all entwined with each other. Intuition, all of these forces end up interacting like a woven cloth. I'm going to talk, but interrupt me at any point. You know, I may not give you immediate response, but I'll respond to you soon, because we just might as well converse. There, all of these forces are tied up together, and they are really, on one hand, it's the heart and soul of the spiritual path. On the other hand, it's so tricky. I kind of like sometimes just want to leave it aside and tell people, just be good, be nice, do your best, you know, and later on you can worry about this. But of course, that's not possible, because forming, what we're talking about is forming an inner relationship with a sense of divine presence within you. Having that relationship, just as Edwin said, be a genuine superconscious relationship. This is where the subtlety of our path is a friend, but it also, it's a subtle friend, because the majority of religious teaching, when it's not based on yoga, doesn't have a vocabulary and a system for understanding all the subtle levels of internal reality. You have God, you have us, you have Jesus Christ maybe. You know, you sort of have just these elements, but you don't have a clear scientific understanding of how the small self expands until it merges into the infinite self. And so there's a pleasant gap that can be dismissed without clarity. You pray to God, maybe God answers, maybe he doesn't, and that's his mystery, and you just have to have faith. Whereas the yoga practice teaches us to internalize our energy, to move the energy up the spine, to concentrate at the spiritual eye, to open the chakras, you know, to merge into the spirit. So much more clarity and power consciously is possible. Of course, great saints, through the power of devotion, whether they know the techniques or not, just break through all these barriers and find the same truths. But yoga helps us to go systematically. So that's the good news. The good news is there is a way to discuss these things and to actually get some focus on them. Almost all about prayer is really about our own inner detachment and our own faith, not so much that God will answer us, but that there is a beneficent divine power supervising our lives and engaged in everything that happens to us, and that everything in our lives ultimately resolves for the best. Now, that's a very difficult teaching. It's a very challenging teaching, period. But it's an impossible teaching to accept if you don't believe in reincarnation. Because if you look at just one lifetime, it's self-evident that things do not resolve for the best. Scoundrels get away literally with murder, and good people are left, you know, high and dry, or in tragic circumstances, or with great disappointments. What drives people to a belief in reincarnation is the inner conflict between an intuitive feeling of rightness about life hitting up against all the factual evidence that that nobody's in charge and that it's a nightmare. I mean, sort of the two forces. And at a certain point, and people live in various relationships to that. I have an elderly uncle who's 95 now, he's a teacher for me. I would have to say he's an inadvertent teacher for me. He doesn't mean to teach me. He tries to teach me. He tries to teach me things that I think are wrong, but he teaches me by example. He's very, very extremely materialistic and cynical and negative, I mean, toward God and religion, intensely negative toward God and religion. Let's see, what was the point of my bringing him up? Let me just get back to it for a minute. You know, he's just looked at life hard and factually and just decided that you make the best of it, you do what you can, but that there's just nothing else like that. He's miserable in that thought, but he's absolutely committed to it. Now he's slightly demented, and he's just totally fixed in that thought. He was always fixed in it, even when you could reason with him. Now he just can't argue back with you with quite as much energy, which I enjoy, that he can't. But he hasn't suffered enough to be willing to let go of this intellectual construct that he's made. He is suffering a certain amount because he's demented enough to be impaired, but undemented enough to know that he's impaired. It's a very difficult position. And I watch him suffering, and a certain amount of me naturally feels compassion for him, and a certain amount of me just thinks, you know, this is basically, you've got to go through this because you've been so committed to your intellect, so certain of it, and so fixed in your ideas, you know. Something's got to break you because you're wrong. You're not saying something. I mean, I know he's wrong not merely because of my belief in something else, but because it's ugly and makes him miserable what he believes. And I have too much experience of the foundational beauty of existence. He doesn't. You know, he likes being nasty and angry. I've shared with some of you, he loves to tell stories about how stupid people did stupid things. And how he was the only one that knew, but no one would listen to him. Fortunately, he's losing the capacity to do that, but every so often he does. And when he absolutely insisted on telling me a story, no matter how much I tried to get out of it, I finally saw I just had to listen to it. And he told me the whole story, which I'd heard about 15 times before, about how stupid they all are and how he's the only one who knows and they don't listen to him. Later I said, "Do you enjoy just going over and over again all the things that make you angry?" He said, "Yes." And he does, because that's still where he's at, you know. He still wants to be superior and to disqualify the others and have all that, yeah. It was like totally changed my way of relating to him. This is where he gets his energy. I can't try to take it away from him. I had a similar experience with my dad, actually, just before, in the last years of my father's life, when I was really trying hard to get him to see something in regard to my mother's health care. It was a very important issue. And he was being very himself, which is similar to his brother, you know, just fixed. And we were having what really was an argument. I mean, neither of us was letting it escalate to a real argument, but it was a pretty intense disagreement. And I finally thought what I would play my trump card. "Don't you want to just expand your awareness and understand more?" He said, "No." Just like that, "No." And then I think what he articulated to me was, "I've suffered enough. I just want to just keep it to a minimum." And to him, to expand his awareness meant to expand his suffering, and he was not interested. He just wanted to have as little more terrible happen until he got to the end. Now, what I'm saying about all that is that people have their own natural level. But there comes a point, and the real question is, where are we in that? Because this is the substance of faith. Where are we in the balance point where we wholeheartedly know, or to what extent do we know, that God exists, that God is good, that God is personal, that God is looking out for my life, however we define that force, and that he's really there, and that I don't know everything. I don't have the full picture. In other words, humility. Humility in the face of a power and an intelligence and a wisdom that is accessible to us and that we will understand, but we may not understand yet. So all of our confusion in how to pray, what to pray for, whether God is with us or not, sort of lies in these balancing factors. I had a beautiful help from a college friend, a friend who was in college, long since I got out of college. He was younger than I. And we were talking about how he got on the spiritual path and why he was interested in these teachings. And he said that he used to be at least agnostic, if not actually atheistic, until he started studying mathematics. And he said one of the principles of higher mathematics is that everything resolves into a harmonious and beautiful whole. And if you're looking for a mathematical solution, and he's talking about a much more sophisticated level than arithmetic, but you know, these mathematical problems where they're talking about the nature of creation almost. He said, if your answer is not harmonious and beautiful in math, it's the wrong answer. Because all of mathematics resolves into harmony and beauty. And he began to realize that if mathematics resolves into harmony and beauty, and the way he understood it, math being essentially one of the building blocks of creation, then everything must resolve into harmony and beauty. And his thought of that there was nobody in charge, it just wasn't consistent. So he began to realize this philosophical conclusion was also false because it wasn't harmonious and beautiful. Now, deep within ourselves, this is what we're always struggling against, which is, do I really believe in my own goodness and therefore in the goodness of creation? Or does a little part of me think that I'm still rotten and that things, you know, that rottenness is a fundamental value? We have this poem of, a building block of creation, you know, like when everything else is taken away, you have good, but you also have rotten simultaneously. There's the poem that Yogananda wrote called Samadhi, which is a poem about his experience of cosmic consciousness. The first line of that poem is very interesting. It's, vanish the veils of light and shade. And I've said that poem to myself hundreds of times. But just the other day I said, light and shade. Master doesn't say vanish the veil of light and dark. And what is shade? Shade is merely something that blocks the light, isn't that so? When something is put into the shadow, it's because the light is there, but something makes it so you can't see it. So what's vanished is the thought that there is both light and shade. And then, of course, the only thing that's left is light. A very, very interesting comment, isn't it? And so there's many different ways for us to perceive the duality of life without having to bow to the common fiction that darkness has an independent reality. There are many things that can block the light. You can turn your back on the light. You can insert wrong ideas between yourself and the light. Other people's thoughts can try to block you from the light. You can move a great distance from the light. The fog of misunderstanding can come in. But none of that will affect whether the sun is shining. It will only affect whether or not you're perceiving it. So all of this has to be the first step for really knowing how to pray, because insofar as these ideas are not clear in your own mind or fight with your mind, then whenever you pray or want to evaluate whether your prayers are being answered, all of these prejudices will make it more difficult to know. Okay? Hi, Suman.
Hi.
Your chair is right there, the one you usually sit in fact. Okay. Any questions or thoughts about what we've been saying so far?
Makes sense.
Makes sense. Thank you, Edwin. High praise. I'll take it. That's enough. Does it? Can you relate to the process that I'm describing? What about you, Anne? Do you think it makes sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I know that you're less experienced than some of the others, so I was wanting you especially to really grasp. But I was just talking about essentially, God is good, and we have to come to believe that. Mm-hmm. And that he knows what he's doing, and we have to come to accept that.
And the biggie that you said is perception.
Right.
You know, what am I going to look at? Am
right.
I going to look at the garbage over there in the corner? Or am I going to, you know, look at nature and all the good? And
right.
You know, thank goodness my perception is on that side,
yeah,
where it just so outweighs everything
right.
else, but it didn't used to be like that.
Yeah. So you've fought your way to this one.
Yeah.
It's a victory hard won. Yeah.
And to me also, when you pray, when you go to that moment that you really want an answer, are you ready to receive the answer? Because sometimes you receive little answers here and there with people, with behaviors. There are messages that come to you in 24 hours a day. You kind of analyze them, but you're not. If somebody says something in your mind, no but.
Yeah.
See, you start with no but.
Yeah.
How about if it's yes? Kind of you leave it open.
Yeah.
And I've been struggling for 3 years with the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, on this 3 year, I knew it was me, but I didn't want to let it go.
Exactly.
And then I go, okay, mother. But, you know, it's just, I think if you really analyze what you're asking, you receive messages, but you just...
You're not ready. Right. The mind isn't. It's the neutrality. You have to be neutral, and you know we'll come into that thought. You know, in Italian, Swamiji always says there's a phrase in Italian, "Ma è difficile," which means "Oh, but it's difficult." So when something isn't to our liking, we say "Ma è difficile," you know, with the whole. So yes, it's true, but it's difficult.
But I have experienced when I'm really ready, when I'm really tired of dealing with something, I say, okay. And I go to the temple, little temple, and I just, it's like you surrender.
Yes.
You just open your heart, and you just, and you're there, and you might not receive, you express and you say what is needed, and then to me the answer comes either next day, and it really... It's not as scary, but I shouldn't get impressed anymore.
Well,
what
you're saying, what you're finishing through your experience is saying, when we are clear, it's easy to pray and it's easy to get the answers and it's easy to know. But the phrase, the difficult part, is when we are clear. And that, you know, people think that the whole art of prayer is about praying to God, but the art of prayer is to have enough faith to have no fear of any situation and therefore to be clear enough to receive an answer. When I, there's a story in the book I wrote about Swami Kriyananda in which I just simply go through this whole process. In fact, maybe I'll just read that story to you at some point instead of trying to tell it to you. But it's just that, well, the whole issue there was when I was extremely upset about something and I was sobbing to him, it's so hard to know what God wants. And Swami said to me, just very simply, he said, no, it's not. Just like that. He wasn't even scolding me. I was saying, it's so hard to know what God wants. He said, no, it's not. And then he didn't say anything else. And I had to finally just sort of give up and go home because he wasn't going to talk to me anymore about what I thought was such a profound philosophical question. He just dismissed it like that virtually. And so I was a little bit annoyed, except that my experience of him had been such that I knew he was neither inconsiderate nor flippant nor impatient nor ignorant. And this had been his answer to my very serious question. So I didn't like it and I wanted to blame him, but I couldn't. I just... Too many forces were conflicting. So I went in to meditate and I thought, well, it may be easy for him to know, but it's not easy for me to know. But then I'm also conscious that Swami is very conscious of the words he chooses. He didn't answer me by saying, well, it's not hard for me to know, which is like what sometimes people would say. I'm having so much trouble doing it. I don't know, it's easy for me. But that's not what he said. He said, it is not hard to know. So once I sort of worked through that, I thought, well, it is hard for me, and if it's not hard and it's hard for me, and this is in my meditation, I'm sort of having this inner conversation with Swamiji or with whomever, and I'm saying, but it's hard for me. Why is it hard for me? And the answer, unmistakable, and this one I knew was from God, said, because you don't want to know. Just like that, you don't want to know. And part of me wanted to say, yes, I do, yes, I do, yes, I do, you know, but there was a little bit of like, maybe that wasn't an appropriate response, even though part of me wanted to say it. And so then I asked a very different question, and the question was, why don't I want to know? I think I want to know. What part of me doesn't want to know? And again, the answer was crystal clear. It said, because you're afraid. And I remember when I was 18 years old, when I was my 1 year of college at Stanford University, and I was part of this whole freshman dorm scene. It was just before they integrated the dorms, men and women, so we were just women together in this dorm. It was the last year of this kind of formality, served dinners with china and silverware. It was sort of a bygone era ended in my 1 year. And all these 18-year-old women together. And man, it was the most unhappy group I'd ever seen in my life. Everybody was terrified, just terrified of being misunderstood, of not being accepted, not being loved. You know, just fear every direction that you could look at. And the whole social scene, as far as I could see, was like in a gridlock situation because everyone was afraid to make the first move. You know, perhaps I'm exaggerating, but that's how I remember it. Just, we were stuck. And so I decided that if just one person pretended not to be afraid, because I was just as scared as everyone else, so I decided to pretend that I wasn't afraid. And I started pretending that I wasn't afraid and just making connections as if there was no fear. And it was like, at least in the circle that I moved in, it just, you know, the gridlock dissolved, because as soon as somebody moved, everybody could move. And the day I made that decision, I made one friend in college that I still have, and I met her that day. We became friends that day. And several other relationships that were significant for that year all started the day I made that decision. Now, I began to think then a lot and came to the simple and obvious conclusion that the single most destructive emotion there is fear, because it absolutely clouds and corrupts everything. So when, all these years later, I'm, you know, having this crisis of sorts, and my inner answer is, because you're afraid. There was nothing in me that fought against that thought. You know, of course I'm afraid. I've always been a very high-strung person, much less so now, but for much of my life, fear was my greatest enemy, because I'm afraid. Well, what am I afraid of? And then the next answer was, well, you're afraid of the conflict between your own desires and God's will. You're just really afraid that these things that you think you have to be happy, you're not going to get them, because God really doesn't see them in the same light that you see them. I mean, that's a more sophisticated way to say it. But it was like, I really felt they were fundamental to my happiness and I absolutely could not go on without them. But I didn't seem to be winning divine support for that idea, no matter how hard I tried. So there's two ways to say that. One is that God doesn't exist. To resolve that, God doesn't exist, or God's an idiot. You know, I mean, there's lots of things you can say. But if you've had enough other experience that doesn't allow you to go there, which is sort of, this is where I'm saying, these two forces, you get trapped in the middle. It's like you're not quite fully surrendered to God, but you've gone too far, you can't be fully committed to your own limited ideas either, and you're just sort of caught in the middle. This is the Battle of Kurukshetra. This is where the war takes place, where we fight between what is really our lower and our higher nature. So I said, okay, what am I afraid of? And then that thought came in general. And then I put my mind to the specific situation that I was trying to sort out. And it was, as soon as I looked at it like that, what am I afraid of? It was obvious to me that I was afraid of losing something I was deeply attached to, and that God was going to take it away from me. So the way I dealt with that was to run around saying, what does God want? What does God want? I pray and I pray and I don't get any answers. What does God want? Because as long as I was desperately praying for an answer, so sincerely, so deeply praying, but not getting an answer, then I didn't have to deal with what was going to happen. And we see lots of people in the world. It's very common to see people who just become problem-oriented. And they just circle and circle and circle their problem, and they feel like they're being conscientious. And, you know, and you try to help them, you try to guide them out to solutions, but, you know, they'll just come right back to the problem. Ma, è difficile. Yes, but. Because they're not capable yet of actually finding a solution, because the solution is going to contradict certain desires and attachments that they have. So the short answer to how to pray is, if you're ever having a problem getting an answer from God, it's inevitably because we're prejudiced in our solution, we're only willing to accept certain answers, or we're praying, we're asking God to give us an answer for a question for which there is no divine answer, which is a more subtle, another aspect of it. But before I go into that, okay, what do you think? Are you with me on that?
I think you hit right on the nail for me, actually.
Okay. Sorry, Edwin. I was aiming.
But you know something? It is true, because, you know, sometimes you pray, but hopefully that's not, you want this answer because you don't want it to, and then you don't want to listen because you know it's, this is going to be a different answer because your desire is this.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
Too long I've sought thee, Lord, only for myself, wanting this answer or that. That's part of the discipleship vow. I'm wanting this answer or that, you know, just going after guidance, but always according to my own system. Now, finally, I'm ready to really listen.
It's just like that saying that we have in Spanish, saying, you know, you go out looking for a job, but wishing not to find one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly
right. You know, it's just like that.
You pray for an answer, but you don't really want God's answer. You want your answer. And so if you don't get it, you pray to another God.
I loved what you said about when you were in Stanford and all the negativity, and you were the one that sort of
all the fear
out of the path and acted as if you were not afraid. And that reminded me that, for me personally, that was a big turning point for me, because I was stuck in that negative thing because of whatever. I mean, I don't even care, whatever it was. And one day I just decided, you know, rather than, you know, somebody says, oh, hi, Kai, how are you? Oh, woe is me. And then give them this whole litany of garbage. I'd say, fine, thank you, and you?
Yeah.
Because I was so sick of talking about me. Uh-huh. And I would just say I was fine. It was like a fake it till you make it thing. And lo and behold.
Because one of the divine principles is, don't think about yourself and you'll be happy.
Oh, yeah. It was such a relief.
Yeah.
I was really sick of it.
Because here's the center, and you circle and circle and circle. And as long as you're asking yourself, well, how do I feel now? And then what do I feel about that? And how did that affect me? And I wonder what this is going to happen. And then what's going to happen there? You know, your mind is about that big. Especially when the center point is self-concern, you know. Not merely self-development, but self-concern. Well, good work, Kaya.
Well, that was an interesting experiment.
Yeah, very good.
So when you felt you were so attached to this, whatever it was, and you were afraid, and then you actually, I don't know what happened, but let's say you didn't get it.
I didn't get it. It dissolved. It blew up in my life.
How do you move on without this, your heart just being disappointed?
Well, my heart was disappointed. I wept. I wept a lot. I wept and wept and wept. I wept and wept. I wept. I wept. I wept. And then one day, I thought, what I want no longer exists anywhere in time and space. You know, it's like it's a disappointment. It's not, no amount of longing is going to resurrect what I have lost. It's lost. Therefore, if I cry over something that does not exist and never ever will exist, I will have to cry forever. And then it just became very practical. Do I really want to cry forever? And I just decided I didn't want to cry forever. It just didn't please me to cry forever, that I needed to get on with my life. Now, if the details of your situation are not so cut and dried, another way to put it is, if I ever have any hope of magnetizing this to me, I need to develop positive magnetism. And if all I ever do is weep, I will never have any positive magnetism, and I'll never get anything that I want. This is an absolute guaranteed way to make sure that this disappointment is followed by countless others. And at a certain point, we just have to scare ourselves into right action, which is a good thing to do. We just have to see, this is not going to take me where I want to go, and this is going to take me profoundly where I don't want to go. This is what Kaya was saying. And then you have to exercise. It is a war. You have to go to war with yourself. But you don't say, I'm not disappointed. You don't say, oh, everything is perfect and it's all worked out just the way it should. You could say, this absolutely stinks. You know, and you can say that really out loud to a Divine Mother. I think this is the rottenest thing that you ever planned, and I don't care whether you think I chose this. I must have been drunk. I would never have chosen this. I mean, you can be just as straight and as forceful. But after you finish that, you see, Jesus set the example. Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, he did it more delicately, but he said, Lord, let this cup pass from me. He said, I know what's about to happen. we don't want to do this. This is terrible. And it wasn't because he minded being crucified at all, but what he minded was, ah, Jerusalem, again and again the prophets come and you scorn them. We would uplift you. We would give you freedom. We would give you all this of God's love, and instead, in your pride and stupidity, you reject us one more time. So what Jesus was asking was that the people that he'd come to serve not have to experience this bitter cup of their own bad karma. You know, let this cup pass away. But then he said, but thy will, not mine, be done. So I figure it's okay to have an opinion. It's okay, in fact, especially, it's not merely okay, if you have an opinion, it's extremely important not to pretend that you don't. Because if you're all mixed up inside yourself about what you really feel, that does not promote clarity. So you need to have the courage to just, and the humility, because sometimes it's profoundly embarrassing to be so far away from what you would want to be, or so incapable of having manifested what you wanted, or whatever the circumstances are. You have to have the humility to just rip open that wound and declare it for what it is. I don't know how I'm going to go on like this. I've always defined my life by this reality. If this doesn't happen, how am I going to go forward? But thy will, not mine, be done. And that's a prayer that God can answer. Because that's not saying, yes, this is good for me. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You should give it to me. You didn't give it to me. Did you not hear me? I want this. This is good for me. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And there's just dead silence on the other side. Because his perspective of what's where your future happiness lies is just bigger than yours. But that doesn't mean you're not miserable in the moment. Is that fair enough? Yeah. And I was intensely miserable. Was the first biggest disappointment in my life. I was just terribly sad. You know, it was all about human relationships. It just didn't come out the way I wanted. I was brokenhearted. I think I could still cry about it if I tried. So there's no, I don't pretend for a minute that I just brushed it aside. I just saw that I just don't want to live the rest of my life here. I want this to become the shape of my heart, not the definition of my heart. You know, and I certainly know that the difficult experiences that I've had have been the making of me. The making of me. Because they soften us. They make us compassionate. They give us understanding of others. They humble us. They force us to be more receptive. All of those things. I mean, I think everyone, I certainly feel that way about every miserable experience I've had. That I cannot separate the miserable experiences I've had from whatever I consider to be the goodness I've achieved. I can't take them apart because they're just integrally related. If I hadn't had those hard knocks, I would still have those rough edges. And not having those rough edges is such a relief that it's hard to say I shouldn't have had those hard knocks. And I'm honest enough to say I don't think less would have gotten through to me. Fair enough. But not easy. There's a really important spiritual principle, which is the spiritual path in relationship with God is very simple, but it's not easy. So it's important to just understand the difference between not being easy and not being complex. Because we think because it's not easy, it must be complex. That's what I was essentially doing with Swamiji when I was weeping at his feet. It's so hard for me to know. It's so hard for me to know. I wanted a big, complicated, long. I wanted him to get in there with me. I wanted him to listen to me, tell him all the details of my misery and have him analyze them with me and then have me tell him new details of my misery. I just wanted to really go. I wanted to talk philosophically about how you know this and how you know that. He just wouldn't do any of it. It's not hard for me to know because it was very simple. I was refusing to accept the inevitable. And I just wanted it to be different. There's a story we often tell. There's this little boy, he's now 20, 30 years old, but he was a an astonishing child. He had so much willpower as a child, just unbelievable. And he lived in our group house in San Francisco, which was a 5-story mansion we rented for about 10 years on Broadway Avenue. Big house. And there was a big wooden staircase that went right through the middle of the house, and the house was hardwood everywhere. So anything that happened on that staircase echoed through all 5 floors of that house. And like 2 in the morning, this kid, he was about 2, he just got out of his crib, he climbed over the side of his crib, he was just bored. He was wide awake and he was bored and nobody was taking care of him. And he just marched to the top of the stairwell. He lived about on the 3rd floor, and he shouted at the top of his voice into the darkness, "I want it to be morning!" He just had it, you know? But it's always just epitomized to me, sort of how we feel for screaming into the darkness, into the night. I want it to be different. You know, and we find that story absolutely amusing because of his stupidity. But are we so different? We're watching our consciousness unfold and we want it to be over. Everybody wants to be, let's see, how do I say it? Everyone wants to be healed, but no one wants to change. Right?
You know, when it's just kind of those, it's ironical, like when I walked in, and I apologize for
that. That's all right, no problem.
And Anna was saying, like, how you don't get the answer you want, or you don't hear. And I was just thinking how we don't hear, and you said we're not clear. And you've used the expression, you know, you have to get out of the way, mm-hmm. Which is a hard part. And I was just, on my way here, I was listening to one of the Treasures talks of Swamiji, mm-hmm. and it was about how to work with your emotions. Mm-hmm. And just as I stopped the car, he said, you know, it says in the Gita that, I guess Krishna is saying to Arjuna, he said, they can count their enemies, but we cannot count ours. Mm-hmm. Right? Because all of those streams of emotions and feelings that we have, so we can't get still because our head is so full with those things. And when you said the fears between your personal desire, mm-hmm. and God's will for you, mm-hmm. right? So how many thousands of those soldiers there were, which is our emotions,
yeah.
and our mind.
But it's still simple.
Yeah.
See, because the reason that the players on the good side are few, what you're saying in the Battle of Kurukshetra, which is the story of the Bhagavad Gita, the forces that can pull you off to delusion are myriad, but the forces that will get you out of delusion are few. There's just a few qualities, you know, surrender, humility, devotion, and the 8 manifestations of God, love, peace, joy, calmness, right. And so you just And there's the principles are just really simple, and what happens is, you cut them off at the root. All those desires. We just took this bougainvillea down from here, which you may or may not have noticed, but in the entryway, just right over here, this huge bougainvillea was growing. It had innumerable branches and thorny branches and so on like that. But and the trunk was big, but we just cut it off at the bottom and then just pulled the whole thing out. You know, we didn't have to cut off every one of those branches. We just cut it off the bottom and pulled the whole thing out. And the bottom is what I was saying earlier, whether or not we actually believe that our egoic perception is insufficient to declare where our happiness is going to come from, whether we actually believe that there is a power. Now, and if we believe that, and that's why we have to work on our faith a lot. We have to... Every little thing that happens to us that reinforces, every little experience that shows us the difference between, oh, I thought that was a good idea, but now I see that it wasn't. I don't mean to make us stupid or helpless, but every time we have the opportunity to expand our understanding, we need to deeply remember that and recognize, oh, look, sometimes I really think I have the whole picture, but then I get bigger. And even if it's just looking backwards, oh, a few years ago I really thought that was a good idea, but now I understand that something else was trying to happen. Oh, this morning I really thought this was the way to do it, but now I have new facts, and now I see there's another way to do it. So it makes us attentively interested, willing to go forward with what we know, on the basis of what we know, but always willing to learn something new. And then we ask ourselves, where does that end? It becomes a habit in the way we relate to life. I have confidence in my own point of view, but I'm always willing to listen. That's why Swamiji so many times says, you know, I'm very strong in my opinions, but ask the people who know me, I'll change on a dime if something is brought to my attention that I hadn't taken into account. And it's persuasive. He said, I'll just change in a moment, because he's not committed to his idea. He's just committed to what's right. And so that's how we have to define our own inner reality. We have to be deeply committed to what's right. And when we believe that this is the right thing to do, we should act with full commitment to that. We shouldn't constantly second-guess ourselves. We should act with full commitment. But the commitment is to doing what's right. Right for us, right for the world, however you want to define that word. So as soon as new information comes that shows you that something else is right, oh, well, this is what I have to do now. I mean, and I've worked very hard in certain directions, but then that energy has spent itself, and now something new is required. Or perhaps it was misguided, but I didn't know it until I really put full energy into it. When I, this is also in my, one of my stories was, I worked for 18 months to try to make Ananda Village into a California city, which was a huge political thing that we did in 1980, 81, 82. I worked 18 months on that project, absolutely day and night, just total focus. And finally it just ended. And the whole story is more than I want to tell now. You can read it in the book. But it just ended. It ended because Swamiji said, I think we're done now. And so I just had to, like, all that momentum, you know, with a tremendous amount of individual thoughtful intelligence behind it, all that momentum just stopped, just like that. But I knew that he was telling me the truth. I didn't doubt him telling the truth, and I didn't doubt the truth he told me. But it was unexpected, completely unexpected. So I was just, whoa, like into a wall. But it was marvelously fun for me, because I got to find out, what am I really committed to? Am I committed to this project, or am I committed to doing what I think is the right thing for me to do? And it took me a day or two to kind of parse it apart. But then I was just like, I just let it go just like that. Because I really only ever wanted to do what was right, and if it wasn't right to do anymore, I didn't want anything to do with it. So that's how we have to be thinking in our own minds. Even if we feel God has told us to do it, what we're attached to is doing what's right, not this what that God told me to do. But as long as you think it's what you're supposed to do, you have to do it wholeheartedly, as if there was no tomorrow. Because otherwise nothing good ever comes of it. And so then when we crash and burn, you have to have the humility just to laugh it off. One of my friends who got in so much trouble, he was in so much trouble and everyone knew it. He behaved very badly and everyone knew it. And he was just mortified, and he crawls over to my house practically in the dark of night, you know, like. I said, listen, just lift up your chin, look everyone straight in the eye, smile when people talk to you, and in 2 days no one will even remember. I said, if you bend over and hunker around, I said, this is going to haunt you for years. But if you're just straight up about it, you know, everybody's made mistakes. And he did. And it just faded away like mist in the sunshine. You know, nobody even remembers or ever held it against him, because he just, you know, I was wrong and now I'm going to do the right thing. Now, all this is about prayer, because this is all how we have to be within ourselves when we pray. So, questions or thoughts or comments about this?
What does it fit contentment in that fashion?
Contentment. You know, contentment's a very interesting word, Edwin, because contentment's a slightly confusing word, because people tend to think of contentment as the same as complacency, or they think contentment means the lack of action, whereas contentment actually means to feel complete within yourself. And if you're complete within yourself, then action is easy for you and action is obvious. But if you're acting because you're not complete within yourself, there's always going to be, and of course for everyone there is, because none of us are complete within ourselves until we're self-realized, there's always an element of selfish motive. And the degree to which there's selfish motive, there's attachment. To the degree to which there's attachment, there's fear. And the degree to which there's fear, there's not the freedom to impartially consider all alternatives. So,
I kind of misunderstood.
Okay.
The contentment, I thought I was like, you know, I'm happy the way God made me, and whatever He gives me, I'm happy with it.
It has to be internal, though.
Okay.
You know, you can be completely content with the way things are and still feel that God wants you to do a great work. And you can set your will against every obstacle and transform the whole environment that you're in, but do it with an attitude of contentment, which is to say, my inner peace is not dependent upon my success or failure. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Yeah, that I'm not depending upon any of these things to make me feel content within myself. I already feel content, and from that level, then I will do this work, because then I can do it in the right spirit. Fair enough. Yeah. Why don't we just take a brief break? Thoughts and questions, and then I'll go on to another energy. Do you have any comments since you had a break to think about anything?
I did have a request, and I don't know if it's somewhere later in the agenda, but just with regards to prayer, a particular just tactical question I have is that, you know, I feel I'm talking to God all the time,
right.
Divine Mother. But, for example, I have parents who are struggling, so I'm, you know, saying, please, you know, guide my mother and looking after my father, for example. I just don't know, when is it a prayer versus a worry or that magnetism? Like, you know, I know they say, you know, give it to God and let God take care of it. But yet we also know the power of prayer, especially healing prayer. So is it you say it and then you're just visualizing them in the light? Or is all the time of saying look after them or take care of them or let their lives be a little easier or let them fulfill their karma, you know, the many ways we say things, am I staying in that difficult vibration or negative vibration?
You're partly answering your own question, because insofar as you're afraid, your vibration is not good. So, and, you know, you can tell the difference between worry and prayer.
When you say pray effectively,
okay, well, this is, no, here, there's, okay, so I'm going to go right, what you just asked is right where I wanted to go. This is this book called Affirmations for Self-Healing. Another way it's called, I think this is an old version, it's called Prayers and Affirmations, or I'm not quite sure. What doesn't have a new title, this is an old version of it. Anyway, what this book, though, actually is, on every page for every subject, there is both an affirmation and a prayer. Now, I'm advocating this book, but I'm pointing out the structure of this book. Okay, this book has 52 qualities, and they're all the qualities that a person needs in order to live effectively: good health, peace of mind, perseverance, contentment, wisdom, introspection. You know, if one makes a catalog of the qualities that a person needs in order to be able to live effectively and happily, they're largely covered in here, even humor, working with money. And for every one of them, there's an affirmation and then a prayer. And in the very brief introduction to this book, Swamiji, in such an interesting way, he simply explains. First, is he says that people say we are what we eat, but much more powerfully, we are what we think. Because whatever thoughts are roiling around in our mind really defines our experience. And he says even more powerfully, thoughts are things. They seem to come and go, but a thought has an enduring power. It creates a magnetism of energy. And then that magnetism increases the more we think those thoughts. And so we're always walking around being whatever we're thinking. Kaya gave us a perfect example. People would ask how she was, and then she would tell them, according to this uniquely negative perspective. And then one day she decided not to do that anymore, and simply not doing that began to actually change her actual answer as to whether she was well or not. That would be what you would say. So it wasn't so that you were suppressing the negative and just pretending the good. The negative gradually lost power because you weren't creating those thoughts that made you feel that was reality all the time. Okay? Now then Swamiji also uses the phrase here. He says, no progress is ever created haphazardly. If we really want to accomplish anything, we have to consistently set our mind to it and go forward. And we train people to do everything, but we don't train people to live. We don't just fundamentally train people how to live. I don't just mean how to get along with people, but like, what are the fundamentals of having a happy life experience or a positive life experience? We just launch people out and let their thoughts roil around in their heads and try to control their behavior all the time. We're always trying to control people's behavior, but we give people no guidance. I mean, collectively, of course, we're working on it here, but we give people no collective guidance on how to do something about our thoughts. And so then, because this is a book of affirmations and prayers, he goes on to say, words are crystallized thoughts. You have an amorphous thought in your mind about something, and then you crystallize it. Oh, I don't want that to happen. Oh, I'm so disappointed. Oh, this is so wonderful. And often when we bring it into words, especially when we articulate those words, whatever thought has been in there has now been crystallized and now is much easier for us to see. In fact, the reason that we have to come back into physical bodies and why we don't just get to hang out in the astral world is because everything on the material plane is brought to a sharp focus, because things on the material plane are solid, you know. And if we're not entirely clear in our consciousness, we often need things to be brought to a very sharp focus. I certainly, pointing at both the positive and negative things that's happened in my life, you know, sometimes some quality in me had to explode. I remember many years ago, there was a fundraising. We were doing some fundraising dinners in town. This was Ananda Village. First one was a huge success. We served, you know, like 150 people in the town. And the second one, I was in charge of, and I decided to do Indian food, which was a really, really bad idea. Because at that time, 40 years ago in Nevada County, California, nobody wanted to eat Indian food. But I could cook Indian food well. I'm not quite sure. There was a lot of ego involved. And it was a disaster. And afterwards, Swami just said to me, oh, whenever your ego gets involved, you always make really bad decisions. And, you know, by no means have I avoided that trap since then, continuously. But there's a certain quality. And then when things go wrong, I can say to myself, oh, whenever my ego gets involved, I make bad decisions. You know, a certain thought form gets going about how good I am or how super I'm going to be and everybody's going to like me or whatever the thought form is. But that's motivating me more than a calm, indifferent. So, in other words, experiences are brought to a sharp focus. I really have this desire. I think I want to do God's will, but I only want to really do God's will if I get that. And so the concept is brought to a sharp focus by the nature of the material plane, where things are either or a lot of the time. And you either can or you can't. And there's no third alternative. Now, what he's saying also is how very often he was saying also that, you know, the mere power of the energy we put behind a thought can manifest it or not. He uses as an example, if a person says, oh, I'm so tired, I just can't do anything. And then all of a sudden you get interested in something, and then 3 or 4 hours later you remember that you were so tired. But you put out energy in another direction, and, well, this is fascinating, I'm really interested in this, let me go get the other book from my shelf, let me go on the internet. And all of a sudden you've changed reality. Let me think what the point that I was trying to say is. Yes, exactly. What I was trying to say is you can make yourself tired by the way you think, and you can make yourself not tired by the way you think. And so every time we put out a thought form, in other words, it's not neutral. It's not just a question of, oh, it doesn't matter, it's just my thought. Okay, so Suman's question is very, very profoundly important. Am I praying or am I worrying? Because if I'm only worrying and I'm just running a thought that is really actually only a worry thought, even though I've disguised it as a prayer, what I'm actually doing is worrying. And the more I worry, the more I'm going to worry, the more I'm going to worry, the weaker my magnetism, the less blah, blah, blah. So what Swami, and I'm just going to go, now here's the other points he makes. He says, the difficulty in changing the way we think is that our habits exist on deeper than conscious levels. There's two levels in which we function. One is what we think we are and what we think we know. And the other is the deeper than conscious level in which forces are corrupting our thoughts even before we can think them. And we don't even know that we're being influenced. I certainly have had experiences in my life where I realized, you know, even after decades, that there was just a whole train, a whole way of being that I never even stopped to consider. A humorous example, which is really not so humorous for the people who've had to live with me all this time. In my birth family, we were debaters. And I always thought that conversation and debate were the same thing. I thought when you converse with people, you take turns presenting your best arguments, with a stopwatch, you know. And I was always surprised why people considered the powerful presentation of my best arguments in favor of my point a conversation stopper. I was just taking my turn, and then I was waiting for you to have your turn. Stupid as it sounds, I'm 62 now, I was 50 when I found out that conversation and debate were not the same thing. I just never knew, because that's how we related. That's how you made your way in the family that I was born into. You know, it was a hearty give and take. A lot of Jewish families are like that, and I know other Jews who were raised in the same way. We can all talk to each other like that. But when you talk to the wasps like that, they don't know what you're talking about. And often they're mortally offended. And others. Now, that was like a deeper than conscious level in which no matter how hard I tried to be nice, I just had that thought. I could never get what was really guiding me. And of course, many, many, many fears and anxieties and so on. And past life experiences, you know. Anne, you speak of a deep disappointment that you've been experiencing. If God leaves you disappointed for the rest of your life and you die disappointed, you're going to have an inclination to expect disappointment the next time you're born, unless you can eradicate that from your heart. If you were murdered in this lifetime, you'll be born with the sort of slight anxiety that people are out to get you. I'm sure that I've been in concentration camps, or else I'm just influenced by my Jewish upbringing. Because I have spent a great deal of my life expecting to end my life in a concentration camp, which actually informs certain decisions. I'm like, well, there's no point in accumulating, you know, silver or linens or furniture or anything like that, because it's all going to be taken away from you when you go to the concentration camp. It hasn't actually even been a trauma. It's just been a fact. What's the point? Because you're going to lose it all in the end anyway. It's been spiritually helpful. I've gradually, somehow recently, lost that. But it was just the way I thought. Now, what we need to be able to do when we're praying, and this is the second half of what I was saying, I talked about you have to be clear. You have to know what you really want. You have to know what's really motivating. You have to know what you're really being afraid of. How can you? Because some of it is from lifetimes that you don't even remember and can't conjure. It's just the way we're oriented. So we have both the conscious and the subconscious level that are putting out these preconceptions. And so when we try to pray with clarity and freedom and surrender, it's a little more difficult because those forces are influencing us whether we know it or not. Now, we don't have to be paranoid about it. But the extent to which we are biased against even what we're praying for, our thought forms are going to be much weaker, aren't they? Right? So this is why the book is Affirmations and Then Prayers. Because what he's suggesting here is that we need to create a very positive climate of positive expectation, of hope, of clear-minded commitment to what we're asking for. And that's the homework we have to do, in a sense, before we pray. Otherwise, because as Swami puts it, there's a tendency for our prayers to be beggarly, is the word he uses.
To be what?
Beggarly. We pray like beggars. Mm-hmm. Oh God, I'm so unhappy. Can't you help me? See me crying down here. Won't you do something for them? Look how much they're suffering. I've asked and I've asked. Can't it ever work out right for me? You know, just, we've all prayed those prayers. But as Master said, those are the prayers of a beggar. Those are the prayers of a supplicant. There was this woman that I knew. She had a demeanor to her that because my life experience was so different, it was a long time before I became educated enough about her psychological syndrome to know what was going on. She'd been raised by an alcoholic mother. And the alcoholic mother was very unpredictable because, of course, sometimes she was drunk and sometimes she wasn't. And when she wasn't drunk, she was always peculiar. And so the daughter was raised never getting any straight answer for anything and never really quite knowing what was going to happen next. And she developed the habit of just asking her mother over and over and over and over again, because often the next answer would be different than the one just before it. So when in her relationship with me, where I tend to say what I mean, and I say it directly, and I say everything because I debate. I put all my best arguments out on the table. I say everything I mean, and I mean it. And then we would start over again as if I hadn't answered. And she would just do this over and over and over to me. And, you know, I learned to be kind and to be patient and do lots of things that were good for me. But I also kept thinking, why are you begging me all the time? That was how it felt. And it gave me a perfect example of how we relate to God. If I keep asking you, maybe the answer will be different next time. You know, I'll just keep saying it and saying it. In other words, also, you have all the power. I am completely helpless in the face of your whimsy, and I don't know what your whimsy is, so I'll just keep begging you and hope that something will be different. Like the people on the street who are asking for 25 cents. Please give me 25 cents. Oh, please give me 25 cents knocking on your window. 25 cents, 25 cents. You know, it's very, it's not even a question of unattractive. It has no magnetism. You know, it's like one is not drawn to relate. And also it says, I'm helpless and you have all the power. Now, Master tries to really help us to understand this is not our relationship with God. You know, first of all, the Divine Spirit is within us. We're not weak. We're one with the infinite. And secondly, God is not a tyrant. He's a loving mother. He's a loving father. He's a wise friend. He's a dear companion. He's an eternal lover.